Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
That's just scratching the surface. A bit of what you'll see in the future from a product perspective is going to be in that realm.
Dr. Richard Lawrence, head of genome editing at Bayer Crop Science.
So if you think about what nature does not do well, nature does not, one, it's really slow to create spontaneous mutations that are useful, but two, many mutations are combinations of mutations that are useful, or that's even slower and poorly sampled in the environment. What editing allows you to do is actually create that same type of a more targeted type of variation towards performance characteristics really rapidly that we think is going to allow us to accelerate our ability to, one, design new crops and to accelerate the performance characteristics of the staple row crops around the world.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I've had the good fortune of spending 20 plus years studying consumer demand, consumer reactions to food and agricultural related biotechnology.
Dr. Jason Lusk is Vice President, Dean of the Division of Ag Sciences at Oklahoma State.
And if I had to summarize a lot of that work very succinctly, I would say that most people in most places know very little about food and agricultural biotechnology. So as a result of that, what we see is how you frame questions, what labels you put on products, what framing you put around the topic, what information you give can have substantial impacts on whether people find food and ag biotechnologies acceptable or unacceptable, worth eating, not worth eating, or what premiums they might be willing to pay to either have or avoid some of those technologies. And so I think because of that, I think it's really, I think, useful and important to understand what benefits technology can convey in biotechnology. I think the research also suggests that the less foreign, so to speak, an intervention might be in terms of biotechnology, the more acceptable it is to the public. So because of some of those things, I've long thought that, you know, the answer to consumer acceptance of food and ag-related biotechnologies might rely in the technology itself, meaning can technology evolve in ways that create food and agricultural products that people can relate to, that provide more direct benefits for them, that occur in ways that seem less foreign.
Lusk at a recent Farm Foundation forum, joined by Dr. Alan Van Deens with the University of California, Davis.
I wrote an article about a year and a half on the importance of gene editing for sustainability and in the nutritional security worldwide in the United States. And it went out to hundreds of thousands of subscribers to, you know, very large servers and things like that worldwide. And I thought, you know, okay, you know, I'm going to get all sorts of emails and hate mail and things like this. And I only got two responses, two emails, and both of them said, thank you for writing that. And so I think it just really echoes what Jason said. People, this is not the main thing people are worried about today. It certainly wasn't, you know, just the response that I thought. So I'm going to jump into gene editing, you know, and what we've been working with. And the title is An Opportunity to Play. And part of that is, unlike GMOs, for most part, small companies, small crops, and public has been kind of out of the game. And we hope this is something that that we can, you know, really use and get out and get products out.
But where could we be going with gene editing?
You know, gene editing is just one of the tools that plant breeders use. And there's a continuum of new tools developed. And if you go back to the original tools of really understanding genetic principles with Gregory Mendel back in 1865 when he first released them, and we go on to, you know, learning about statistics, experimental design, I put biotechnology, and notice it's kind of in the middle there. Really in the 50s, late 50s, we talked about tissue culture, mutation breeding. Transgenics came around in the early 80s and genome editing in the early 2000s. But we have all sorts of other technologies that we're working with, like speed to market technologies, counter seasonal nurseries. This is what Norman Borlaug and the Green Revolution really counted on. But machine learning, genomics, high throughput phenotyping, artificial intelligence, and then, of course, intellectual property and education. So again, it's gene editing is just something that plant breeders and animal breeders and so on, you know, will use.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Looking at the board today and looking at how things traded over, you know, the last 4 or 5 months, it is a market, these are markets, I should say, in the grain and oilseeds that are having a tough time trying to get anywhere close to where they were around the first quarter last year and get anywhere close to where they were in the summertime of last year.
Bob Mowers with Manduca Trading in Chicago.
And we've just seen prices have a hard time finding new buying, even when we get to what have been the relatively recent highs of the recent trading ranges. So just a bit of struggling going on. A number of things are happening. First of all, just to get this out of the way, we've got a slew of reports at the end of this week. So I imagine that there's not going to be a tremendous acceleration to the downside. This is just me hypothesizing, thinking that nobody's going to want to be overly short going into the reports that we have this Friday, all coming out at the same time, which would be 11 a.m. Central, being that they might pose some kind of surprise. So we'll see how these trade over the next few days. But that said, we've got the annual crop production report. We've got the quarterly grain stocks report. We've got the monthly WASDE supply demand report, and we've got the winter wheat seedings report, all going to be released on Friday at 11 a.m. So the market's going to get a huge data dump. What I won't do right now is give you all the estimates, because that's just way too much information to throw out over the airwaves for people to really grasp onto. But if somebody does want to give me a call, I've got a nice little summary on what could be expectations and also how accurate those numbers have been over the years too. So I'll just leave that like that. So that aside, the report's coming out on Friday, kind of indicating to me that I don't think we're going to go overly one way or the other. You're right. We did show up with some weakness today. Corn down 5-6 cents. Wheat futures down anywhere from 7 to about 20, depending on which one you're looking at. And then soybeans down about 10-10.5 cents. And really, the drivers at this point from a high level are a few things. First of all, there's been a fairly significant lack of noticeable selling from the farmers out there who are naturally long over the past month and a half or so, especially in the corn market, potentially in the soybean market, but especially in the corn market. So what that means is that there's a lot of pent-up potential selling that could be hitting these markets, and I think that's been one of the drivers of why the market's been unable to sustain any kind of rally. Bigger picture in terms of those balance sheets, and again, we'll get some new data at the end of this week, but in terms of just looking at the carryover for the grain markets and the oil seeds, it doesn't seem to be anything real scary there that would kind of give somebody the opinion that probably long is not wrong, let's put it that way. And there seems to be ample amounts around the world. And then also, we've got some adjustments that are happening, generally speaking, with, for example, what's happening in the Red Sea and the shipping lanes being stopped, ceased, slowed, whatever kind of word you want to put it to describe what's happening there. And we're seeing how that's affecting our markets here in the U.S. and as much as the Pacific Northwest could be the primary market, especially going out to origins like Japan and Korea, for example. Also keeping an eye on the other ramification of what's happening there in the Red Sea, which is the insurance rates are ratcheting pretty higher again, probably helping to lean to see if the market here in the Pacific Northwest of the United States becomes one of the primary players, kind of avoid that whole bottleneck, or at least the rerouting all the way, you know, to the South Pole, it seems like, just trying to get the ships around. So we'll see how that all plays out.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My entire first year, well, my first 11 months, we could not travel out of Beijing because of the lockdowns. The penalty was, if you want to go to Shenyang or Chengdu, you could go, but then you'd stay there for 10 days under lockdown. You couldn't get back to the capital. Too high a price to pay.
Nicholas Burns is the U.S. ambassador to China. Speaking recently at the Brookings Institute on U.S.-Chinese relations.
We had lockdowns and mandates in China that made it impossible for my staff and I to travel. Shanghai lockdown, our consulate lockdown there. Real crisis situation. The president had a good meeting in Bali at the end of 2022, but then you all remember the balloon incident of the beginning of February of 23. That was preceded by the controversy over Speaker Pelosi's visit. So the Chinese reaction vote to Speaker Pelosi and the balloon incident was to shut down most senior level conversations between the U.S. and China. I thought that was very dangerous and ill-advised of the Chinese. And as of late spring, early summer of this year, we were in a situation where we did not have any highly developed cabinet contacts. We didn't have channels where the Secretary of State or Treasury or Commerce could call their counterparts and work out issues. We were active in Beijing. Obviously, that's our job, but you want to have that higher level. And so we decided, along with the Chinese, that we had to change that situation. So it's been a remarkable last 7-8 months. Secretary Blinken was the first Secretary of State to visit China in 4.5 years. That was June. Secretary Yellen came out in July, first Secretary of the Treasury in 4.5, 5 years. Secretary Raimondo came out on her first visit to China, first visit by Secretary of Commerce in 4 or 5 years. You can see how separated we have become. John Kerry came out. The really extraordinary visit, in a way, was Henry Kissinger's visit. 100 years of age, I met him at the airport. It was about 102 degrees in mid-July, 2 in the afternoon, and he had just had a 20-hour flight. And he came off the plane and engaged in 5 days of conversations with Xi Jinping. He did a half-day seminar on AI with China's leading, along with Eric Schmidt, with China's leading AI scientists. He came to the embassy, and 700 of us honored him for being the father of this relationship in many ways. So I think that visit was not our visit. He was invited by President Xi, but it helped to normalize the coming together of the two peoples. And then we had the first visit by a congressional delegation, any congressional delegation, when Majority Leader Chuck Schumer came, 3 Democrats, 3 Republicans, 80-minute meeting with Xi Jinping on fentanyl, on trade and investment, on the Gaza war. We came together. We re-engaged. Our first governor came out, Gavin Newsom, shortly thereafter. So I take you through that list. We had nothing like this in 2020, 2021, 2022. The two governments had separated. What we've done is to plug the governments back in together so that we can at least have open conversation on the competition side and the cooperation side. And I think over the next 12 months or so, as I look at 2024, implementing the agreements from California is going to be very important. Keeping the two governments connected through thick and thin is important. The Chinese practice, when you hit major speed bumps, is to disengage. That is not smart. And we want to keep these contacts going. So that's where we are in terms of the methodology of this relationship.
U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns, recently at the Brookings Institute. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We believe that in its most fundamental, most innovative application of genome editing is in a way where you apply the technology in a way that you really bring together a breeding type of process with genome editing.
Dr. Richard Lawrence, head of genome editing at Bayer Crop Science.
And so one of the key innovations with genome editing and the CRISPR-Cas system that was invented in 2012, 2013 was the fact that, one, it was fast and it was easy to design, which made it scalable. But also it allowed, that system allowed one to make many, many different edits at the same time. And genome editing had been invented in the 80s with zinc finger nucleases, and then it evolved into TALENs, but it was the CRISPR-Cas9 system that took off, that helped the technology take off because it's scalable and allows you to actually make many modifications. And when you think about what that allows you to do, it allows you to really go in and create a targeted variation in genomes that is most like what is currently used in breeding processes, except that you can go in and make very targeted and specific edits and variation at loci that you believe or you have hypotheses that will create new ideal performance characteristics.
And the work that's coming from this, the end result, is extremely exciting.
You think about the domestication of something like corn, which took thousands of years, and a few different key specific mutations were artificially selected on over the years. You know, the separation of the tassel from the ear and the ear placement around the height of where someone could hand harvest it, removal of tillering so that you have one single stem. All of that took thousands of years, but many different spontaneous mutations had to occur, right? And so there's a company called covercress. And what they did is they took a weed, a pennycress weed that occurs naturally in North America, European fields. And within about 7 years and just a few edits, they turned that essentially into a new type of crop. So it's, they've been able to remove the weediness. They've been able to modify the seed composition in a way that it is now suitable for meal, and the oil profile is suitable for a sustainable jet fuel type of value stream. Not to mention it's a cover crop, so it can be utilized to provide a carbon benefit to the soil and to the farmer. So really cool story, just to illustrate what we think genome editing can unlock when you're able to actually make multiple edits to the genome. What it really allows you to do is create new crops, rapidly adapt crops or domesticate crops. And just one other example like that, that's a little bit more like the consumer example, is pairwise recently. I think many of you know the story of brassica species and the consumption of brassica species. So the thousands of years that led to things like of domestication that led to things like broccoli and cauliflower and kale and Brussels sprouts, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what Pairwise did is they essentially created a new type of brassica crop as well in just I think 3, 4, 5 years. And what they did is they took a mustard green that has a really pungent flavor, but is really nutritious, so not really something that people want to eat. And they modified it. They removed, I think, 17-ish different genes. Don't quote me on that. Remove the pungency, horseradishy type of flavor. And now they have a leafy green that has a similar nutritional profile to like a kale. However, it has the crunchiness of a romaine. So again, really cool story about the ability to create something new and novel for consumers really rapidly with this ability to modify many different genes in the genome.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Decent rains were noticed across northern Brazilian growing areas over the weekend.
Bob Mowers with Manduca Trading Chicago.
The next 1 to 5 day forecast is for northern Brazil to be a bit more wetter than it was indicated in the forecast just a few days ago. So ample precipitation down there, shall we say. In addition to that, the guesstimates coming out in terms of production at this point in the crop year down there are nothing scary on the bull side of the equation. So most private estimates in terms of the Brazilian soybean crop are in the 150 to 155 million metric ton range. And if you add that to what the guesstimate is at this point for the Argentinian crop, which also looks pretty good, which is around 50 million metric tons, that gives you 200 to 205 million metric tons coming out of those two primary players down in South America. And that should be ample to grow the size of the balance sheet, being that last year's Brazilian and Argentinian combined production was closer to 185. So we're adding, you know, anywhere from 15 to maybe 20 million metric tons, obviously absent anything new coming along to change expectations. But clearly, in terms of any kind of fear that there would be some kind of slide in the yields and the ultimate production coming out of Brazil and Argentina is not there, and that's helping to pressure corn and pressure soybeans. And when you pressure corn, you're probably going to be pressuring wheat. And I think those are kind of all feeding into each other as we speak. So this is stuff that isn't just new to this year. This has been developing over the last month, month and a half, as the market's been watching it really closely. And it's just been a tough argument to make to be on the long side of this. So that's primarily corn and soybeans. And then if you look at what's going on with Ukraine, with wheat, maybe a bit of bullish news there, a spark, shall we say. The Ukrainian Ag Ministry, they're bringing their total grain exports, we know that their total grain exports since the start of the 23-24 marketing year, which I believe was July 1, is a little bit lower than the same time last year by about 4 million metric tons. So in terms of competition in the marketplace coming out of Ukraine, in terms of specifically for wheat, you know, they're moving a little bit slower to the market than had been in the past, and or at least year on year, shall we say, which, you know, might be considered at some point a bullish element, but you wouldn't know it by looking at today's prices with the market down about 18 or, you know, roughly 8 to 20 cents, like I mentioned. And if you dial out, I mean, basically you look at some of the other things that are impacting the markets, if that's not enough for you already, shall we say. And Brazil, in terms of soybeans, they're expected to export about 1.3 million metric tons in January, up from 940,000 in January of last year. So 400,000-ish, say 360,000-ish more than last year. And then in terms of, you know, just kind of keeping a picture of things, one of the big stories had been the massive rally in soy meal, and that was because of the abysmal production out of Argentina, but that just clearly seems to be correcting in as much as soy meal has had a pretty good slide, and we'll be watching those crush rates to see if, you know, there's still going to be a good appetite for the crush going down the road. And then in terms of wheat, we're just going to continue to watch the weather. Had some good rains here in the U.S. across the southern plains. That's helping to put some pressure in the market. I think they're also expecting a bit more, especially in areas like Texas, Oklahoma panhandles, as you would know well. And then maybe western Oklahoma, we'll see if that plays out. And then in terms of corn, again, just the rather slow side of things in terms of the demand and the fact that the big money players here, the fund flows that most traders who are heavily involved in the markets are going to watch pretty closely because they can impact the overall trend in a particular market, that looking at the managed money from the commitment of trader reports. You know, for the most part, it seems like they're lightening up, if not adding to the short side of the equation for some of these markets. And, you know, that's putting some pressure too. So
it's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We're trying to balance the national security interests on competition with the national security interests on engagement.
U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns.
We have a $690 billion two-way trade relationship between the U.S. and China. China's the third largest trade partner. Number one and two are Mexico and Canada, free trade neighbors of the United States. 750,000 American jobs depend on trade with China. Largest market for agriculture, consumer products, health care. Look at the major parts of the American economy. 40 years has developed this extraordinary symbiosis in the two economies. We made a determination early on that Secretary Yellen articulated right across the street at Johns Hopkins. And then Jake Sullivan came here to Brookings to articulate last spring. We're not trying to decouple these two economies. Secretary Yellen was very specific. She said that would be a disaster for the American and Chinese economies and the global economy. I was with her last night. We both spoke at the gala dinner of the U.S.-China Business Council. She went through this again and said we are not trying to decouple. President Biden said at his press conference in California, we are against decoupling, so we're not trying to tear this relationship apart. Jake Sullivan came here in a very important speech, and I read the Q&A from Brookings last spring, and the Q&A is really important, where he said, okay, we're not decoupling, but we have to de-risk. What does that mean? The fundamental lesson we draw from the pandemic is that you don't want to have undue reliance on critical materials and critical supplies from a country that might practice economic coercion against you in a crisis. You want to bring the supply chain for certain products and supplies closer to home. The United States itself or Mexico or Ireland, some trusted source. And Jake focused on what Secretary Raimondo's focused on. We want to prevent dual-use exports from American companies into China, prevent their use by the PLA to modernize and therefore compete with the United States military in the future. The example is October 2022, and the additional action we took on October 2023, we have shut down the ability of American companies to export advanced semiconductors, particularly for AI applications, into the Chinese economy. Why? There's a civil-military fusion. The government of China can go to any Chinese company and say, we want that IP, we want that product, we're going to use it for intelligence or military purposes. It's in our national interest, and it's irrefutable to keep that technology part of the battle outside of China. Secretary Raimondo was very effective on this issue during her visit in August. She said to the Chinese leadership, I'm not going to compromise with you on these dual-use technologies. They are non-negotiable. This is our national security. And we've all said that to the Chinese leadership. So de-risking, yes. Decoupling, no. We want to continue a major trade and investment relationship with China, just not in the in the realm that might help them leapfrog over us sometime in the next 10 years in military technology.
So what about the accusations?
First of all, they were accusing. They said, you're decoupling. And I kept saying, we're de-risking. And there's a fundamental difference between the two. What they forget, and which I have pointed out to them and others have, is you're doing the same thing. China began its real de-risking with Made in China 2025, which they made public in 2015. They accuse us of de-risking when they've been doing the same thing. These are logical policies for both of us to follow. We're just a little bit more transparent about what we're doing than the Chinese are.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Agriculture Department is investing record amounts of money into conservation and climate change programs.
There are four things that we really need to work on as we move those investments forward.
Undersecretary of Agriculture Robert Bonney telling a conference in Des Moines Tuesday that first thing,
we need to make sure we have the right practices, that we're being sensitive to what producers need on the ground,
and physically able to deliver those needed programs. And so
we're going to hire some new staff. We've got new resources. We're going to need to be able to have some additional people to work in partnership with farmers and ranchers and forest owners to get it out there.
But Bonney says it will take more than just USDA people to do it.
We're looking for ways to partner with states, with conservation groups, with commodity groups, with conservation districts and others on the ground to help us implement these programs.
And finally, Bonney says the whole farm program process needs streamlining.
We've got to do a better job of making it easier for producers to get into our conservation programs.
He said reducing red tape's a goal running through all USDA programs, not just conservation. Gary Crawford, Washington.